You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video on demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. Today, I'm super happy to have Teppo with me. Welcome to the show. Maybe you can introduce yourself shortly to the audience.
Thank you, Alexander. Hello, everyone. So I'm Teppo Huttunen. I'm a statistician and I come from Finland in Turku, so southwest Finland, or 50 kilometers from Helsinki. I did my statistics studies in the Turku University, graduated 2004. And from then onwards, I've been working with the drug development and a long time in a Finnish CRO. And then 3.5 years ago, me and a couple other colleagues, we started our own company, Eskimage, which we have been now running. And we have been now developing the company and we have a group of 10 experts there. We also have data managers, we have programmers, we have also a small data science unit. But me and then many people, we have a background in statistics and in the biostatistics. So that was where my career started. When we had in Turku University, there was a master's program focusing on the development statistics.
Yeah. So you're basically a boutique CRO. What are your typical clients that you look for?
We are collaborating a lot with the biotechs. The biotechs don't usually have their own statisticians. Then we can operate as their internal statisticians and be the statistical experts there. Then we can conduct like also the operative part, but then many occasions we are doing, there might be a CRO involved and we are doing like the statistical oversight. That is typical. We also serve some clients in the functional food. So there we are more doing the operative role, like in the food studies. But then also with different kinds of pharma companies, there might be early phase studies like DK studies and these kind of studies from different sectors.
Okay, cool. Very good. So today we want to talk specifically about oncology and especially immune oncology. And one of the first challenges that you will get into when you develop these drugs is, of course, the dose selection. And I'm not an oncology expert, but one of the things that I know about is that lots of these oncology early phase studies, where it's about dose selections, have this 3+3 design. You basically start with 3 patients, you look how they turn out to be, and then you escalate further until you reach some kind of maximum tolerable dose. And that's basically your dose finding. Now, it is known that this design has many different disadvantages. What are a couple of the disadvantages of these studies?
Yeah, like you mentioned, it's really commonly and historically used methods. And basically, it is a very effective method when there is a cytotoxic agent in question.
Yeah.
And then it's purely based on the hypothesis that what is the most tolerated amount of the drug is also the most effective. And then only with three patients, or then if it's the 3+3, 6 patients, you can get this information with quite high probability that, okay, you will eventually run into this maximum tolerated dose. And then you have the dose for your phase two study.
Mm-hmm.
But then now quite long time already, we have been working with the immuno-oncology molecules. And there it is not necessarily that the maximum tolerated dose is the most effective dose.
Okay.
And I think this basic question is like what the companies and the people working with immuno-oncology and in the oncology drug development should understand. And then when you understand this like a paradigm or this issue, so and then you can start to think that, okay, then how do we set the question and questions that we would get the better estimation for what could be the optimal biologic dose.
Yeah. So that's really a paradigm shift from looking into just the maximum tolerable dose to the most appropriate dose in independent, or not independent, of course, there's a kind of a upper limit, but it doesn't need to be this kind of upper limit.
Yeah. I think it's good if you can find it, the limit, because that answers the question then that, okay, what are the safe doses?
Yeah.
But then the next question should be that, okay, what are the most probably efficacy doses?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you should widen the thinking. And yeah. And I think authorities are, of course, aware of this, and they have been, FDA has raised different guidances, and there is nowadays also this kind of fit for purpose stamp on this BOIN method.
What does BOIN stand for?
That's the Bayesian optimal interval design.
Okay.
But basically, BOIN is like a more general, it has the same kind of utilities as the 3+3. Basically, 3+3 is a special case of included in the BOIN.
Okay.
So actually, the BOIN is also answering to the same questions that, okay, what is the maximum tolerated dose? So we are still in the same framework, but there is a lot more flexibility with the BOIN.
How do we get to this more flexibility? What are the other parameters that we can introduce?
In the BOIN, there is a lot of modeling behind, but basically there is, you set up a target toxicity level.
Mm-hmm.
It's also in the 3+3, you are having the target toxicity level basically of 30%.
Mm-hmm.
In the BOIN, you can set up the target toxicity level also to 25 or 20,
mm-hmm.
in case you want to like not allow more toxic agents. And then you have a decision rules for the dose escalation and dose de-escalation, which are not tied to the number of patients. So you can have 3 patients as a cohort size, and then your decision rules are pretty equal to the 3+3,
mm-hmm.
or in some cases even equal. But you can also have the cohort size of 4 or 5, and then it allows that if there are cases where the patients discontinue early and they are not like a DLD, the dose limiting toxicity, evaluable, then you can still make decisions about whether you need to stay on the same dose level or you need to de-escalate or can you escalate to the next level.
Mm-hmm. So basically you can have more flexibility first to understand what is your maximum toxicity that you want to get below.
You are more flexibly moving along with the doses. And then the operational characteristics are built so that you have more patients allocated to the doses around or below the maximum tolerated dose.
Okay.
Because the 3+3 is basically running that you run to the highest level and then you stop.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Boeing, you can, based on the observations, you are moving more around the MDD and you get more information then also about other parameters than only the tolerability.
What are these other parameters that DSM can measure?
It's the responses. It can be also the like PK and PD parameters.
Yeah.
And also the other tolerability, because these dose escalation methods are based on the dichotomic that if there is a DLT or not. But then of course you can have like more milder adverse events.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you can also take it, and here's the responses. So that's basically the efficacy also comes
yeah,
into play.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can basically also model that. So take that into account so that you also get information about the efficacy, not just the tolerability.
Yeah. There are also these kind of models that you can use the same kind of framework and accounting for the efficacy responses. And these are called so-called toxicity and efficacy models. But there, I think I haven't seen those that much in the practice, because already running the model using the DLT events, it starts to be like the somewhat of a practical challenge. And then if you need to follow up also the efficacy responses and include those in the decisions, it starts to get complicated.
Is that because you observe the tolerability faster than the response?
That's partly, I think, one reason. But then, of course, it's also that do you only want to use the dichotomic response information?
Mm-hmm.
Because then, despite of that, you should also consider the P and PD parameters. And then, of course, regarding the efficacy, the number of patients is quite limited.
Mm-hmm.
If you have one response out of three and then hit the other dose, you have zero response out of three, it doesn't necessarily show that, okay, the one with the single response is really better.
Yeah. So it only gives you some preliminary information. It's a preliminary information. Could be enough to design the phase 2 study in a better way.
Of course. Yeah. And I think that's also like important that the companies would understand that, okay, the answers we get from the tolerability, which might be already quite like convincing that, okay, it's not safe anymore. But then the answers at that time point for the efficacy are still very preliminary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the basis why, for example, the FDA is trying to give more guidance to this dose optimization and that you should take to the phase 2 several doses, at least 2 doses.
Yeah, yeah. But I think then if you get basically through that model-based assumptions, you can then have better informed decision for what is a good dose selection for phase 2.
Yeah. So it's really about the gathering as much information as possible. And then, of course, there are like budget issues. And also in the early phase, you might have like several cancer types, because mm-hmm. that's also like very common in the early phase studies, especially in the oncology, that, okay, when you're dealing with the tolerability, you can have many different cancer types.
Okay.
Because you think that for the tolerability, it doesn't matter. But then for the efficacy, it might matter.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's also a possibly confusing factor.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that is, of course, I would say, pretty important, because your phase 2 study would only be in one indication, not in many.
Yeah, usually at least you start with one indication. Then, of course, if you have promising results, you might go into several indications. But that's my experience, that usually you focus then on one or two indications in the phase two.
Yeah, that's
it might be also a budget issue. I think a couple of years back there was a lot of talk about these basket trials, but now I think I see it's better to go a little bit stepwise and focus first on the one or two indication.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a time and budget issue.
Yeah.
If you have lots of budget, of course, you can go more risk and develop more things in parallel. But if money is constrained, and especially in the past years where the interest rates have been much higher, there was much less money in the biotech area. And so I think that definitely probably had an impact on these kind of decisions.
Yeah. I think there has been many of these kind of drivers that in the immuno-oncology, that when it started to develop, then came the basket trials, then also had this possibility that you can, and it still has the possibility that you can get early approvals with single agent or single arm trials.
Yeah.
And now it seems that, okay, they want that the companies focus more on the dose optimization. They want also that, okay, you need to have at least some amount of evidence from the randomized comparison and so on.
Yeah. Which, just from my kind of experience with single arm trials, is, I think, a good decision to have more of that evidence for them.
Yeah. I think it's really good, and it shows that as always the authorities know quite well what they are doing, but what is happening on the field, and then they get used to all of the information that they have seen. So
yeah, much. So in what is the kind of key takeaway that you want the listener to get away from this discussion?
I think one key is to understand the paradigm. And then if you deal with the immuno-oncologic drug, first of all, the 3+3 is like a historical.
Mm-hmm.
Because in some cases, it could still be considered if you only need to somehow show that, okay, these dose levels are safe. But then you need to understand that you are not getting any more information. Regardless, the Bayesian is more flexible. It's basically still giving the same kind of answer, but it's more flexible in practice. And then in the Bayesian, there is also flexibility that you can have more patients around the maximum tolerated dose. So you have more information. You can even have, there's this word that is used, backfilling, when you are running the dose escalation and you are proceeding, and so you have been basically proven that the earlier doses are safe. Then at the same time, you can start to include patients to these levels that you have passed using the backfilling. So then instead of having 3 or 6 patients per dose group, you could have, for example, 10 patients per dose group at the same time. So you can go along with the dose escalation. And at the same time, you can collect a little bit more information still within the same framework. So you are following these patients, you are backfilling, you're still following. If there's a DLT, you can incorporate that information into this Bayesian framework. And then the framework is telling, okay, what is the next dose? What is where you should allocate the next patient? Of course, there are also other methods like the CRM, the continuous reassessment method. So it's, I think, also an option, but in some cases, what I have noticed is that, okay, then it starts to be tricky with the clinicians and the other operative people in the clinical operation.
Yeah.
So I have found that the Bayesian, that they can understand, and then they like the flexibility. And then also from the statistical side, if you incorporate this kind of backfilling options, and so you have maybe then 10 patients per 4 dose group, you have quite a lot of information then to inform that, okay, what would be the 2 doses you take forward to the phase two.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great summary. And we'll also put a couple of links into the show notes regarding this. And of course, also a link to Teppo's company, Estimates, which, by the way, I find a really nice name. And he also has a pretty nice logo for that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, my colleague Mika designed the logo. Yeah, it's nice that you recognize this.
Yeah, I had something similar in my PhD thesis, and I liked that very much. Thanks so much for that kind of interesting discussion about the paradigm shift that we see within oncology, and especially immuno-oncology, that it's not just about the maximum target tolerated dose, but also taking more of the efficacy data into account.
Yeah, it's the optimal biological dose, but then the question is that, okay, how do you estimate that? And I think there is a lot for us statisticians that's where we can really be a part of, or we need to be a part of that. Of course, then include other professionals as well, like the PD specialists.
Yeah, yeah, this is cross-functional. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. This was very nice. Thanks, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.